This is a presentation by Human Development Outreach and Extension at Cornell University.
It's an honor and pleasure to be here, and let me see if I can get through something coherent within the next hour. My main goal will be to give you a feel of the kind of research that we have been involved with, trying to look at neural substrates of behavior. And I mean, this is a simple illustration of the three corners of the puzzle we are trying to solve. One is behavior, and then we're trying to look at the substrates in the brain anatomy and the brain physiology. And we're still always very... I'm tied to my jacket. We are still always very careful and circumspect when we talk about causality. I mean, that reflects our training in graduate school, that cause is a word we should use very, very rarely. But I think it is fair to say that in this case, we expect that the brain causes behavior, that behavior is a product of brain in the same way that blood going through your circulatory system is a product of the action of the heart. So the heart is a pump, the brain is the organ of behavior. And now, of course, you could draw an arrow going the other direction if we have more and more evidence that behavior...
Your mic's down. Follow down. Yeah, there you go. You want to put that in?
Sorry
about that.
And there is more and more evidence that there is something there, but there is no doubt that if I opened up any of your skulls and scooped out a piece of hippocampus, your memory will become rotten and really disturbed. And you could think of ways to make the same thing happen through behavioral manipulations, but they're much more complicated and convoluted. For years, as Chuck's pointed out, all we could look at was behavior. That was our window to the brain. And really, it started with Broca, who observed this behavior of reduced speech output by Monsieur Lelong, who was able to pronounce only 7 or 8 words, but was able... was not demented. He used those words intelligently. And then after thoroughly documented Monsieur Lelong's deficits, all Broca could do is wait for poor Monsieur Lelong to die. And then as soon as he died, he opened up his skull and saw the big lesion in the third frontal convolution of the left hemisphere. And, you know, the rest is history. That's how our field started. And for years, certainly when I... graduate from graduate school, most of our knowledge came from those kinds of studies, the patients who showed the right kind of behavioral deficits, and they were thoroughly tested to show that this is the deficit, no other deficits, and then we waited to wait for them, so we can look at the brain, open up the skull. You can imagine it's not easy to make tenure with that sort of a research agenda. Really, we needed a way to look inside the brain. But nonetheless, a lot of progress was made, and at the end of it, the field had what they call a neuropsychological battery, and that will be a battery of psychological tests. The only reason they're called neuropsychological is because the reason it was constructed that way is aiming at specific brain system. So obstruction and flexibility is measured, because that's what happens when you get a lesion in the frontal lobe. You lose the ability to abstract principles from instances, and you lose the ability to be flexible. And you see that in extreme cases. For example, Parkinson's patients, Parkinson's disease affects mostly the frontal lobe. If you are in a movement disorder clinic, you'll see those patients coming, and they stand in front of the elevator, and the door opens, and they can't walk. You have to sort of get them started, and then they walk, and they walk till they stop at till the wall of the elevator stops there. It's just very difficult to initiate movement or to change your set once you start. Then attention was measured because it looked like it was affected by lesions in parietal as well as in frontal, so there's attention system. Then we would test for verbal memory and spatial memory because there was increasing evidence of hemispheric lateralization, that if the lesion is in the left, the deficits are more verbal. If it's in the right, it's more spatial. So verbal memory presumably is associated with left temporal lobe, spatial memory with right temporal lobe. Language, of course, after Broca came Wernicke, who showed that deficits in language production may indeed be from frontal lesions, but more posterior lesions would produce deficits in language comprehension. So language would be studied extensively, and spatial functions, more right hemispheric, sensory and motor functions. This battery takes almost a day to administer to a healthy person, and can take even longer to administer to a patient with schizophrenia. But at the end of the day, you do have a map, and we used to study a lot of healthy, and we still do study a lot of healthy people, because whenever you adopt a new method, you need to study a lot of healthy people to know what is normal before you can figure out what is abnormal. So one of the things that jumped at us first when we started to summarize data on large samples that took this particular battery, are sex differences. And those sex differences, so these are Z-scores for each of those functions. So we take all the tests that measure a particular function. We convert the scores to standardized Z-scores. And this is a sample of 124 men, 117 women, all healthy volunteers, age range 18 to 45. And if you look at the profile, you see if women do a little better in abstraction and flexibility, but this is not significant difference, no difference in attention, but verbal memory, women are way better. In fact, I mean, you can see that even in any simple word memory task, and it becomes very dramatic if you do something like the California verbal learning test, where I read to you 16 words and then you're supposed to read them back to me. And then I say, okay, let me read it to you again, and you read me again, and you go that for five trials. Women just zip up and know the list by the fourth trial and asymptote there, and men just barely crawl up. And only it turns out when you do the recognition, was the word there or not, the sex difference disappears. So that information was somewhere in the male brain, but it just wasn't available. So that is pretty big. No difference in spatial memory, no difference in language. Spatial abilities like judgment of line orientation and block design, rotation of objects in three dimensions, men do better. No difference in sensory function, motor function, men do way better. And that particular task was seeing how quickly you can move your finger like that. Men can do that much faster than women. And that's true, but in general, for motor functions. Men run faster, they jump higher. Of course, there is some overlap in the distributions, but there is reason why they divide them into sexes in the Olympics. And in the majority of motor functions, men outperform women. And if you look at the pattern of this difference, it begins to feel like you're not looking at culture, like you're looking at biology, that you're looking at the fact that even though today we do wonderful things with our brains, we fly planes, we have computers, and so on. Our brains were really put together sometime during the Middle Pleistocene epoch, when we were hunters and gatherers in the savanna, and that's what our brains are designed to do, and that looks like what is reflected in those kinds of sex differences. Now, all these deal with cognition. Now, what happened next was we started having tools available for measuring brain activity and brain structure in a live human being. And that was awesome. That was unbelievable. And I encountered it first when we worked with EEG already at Stanford, but it was tough. And I know you probably do some wonderful things with it, but at that time, there weren't really the tools to do much with it. So I was thrilled to find out that there is a method where you can actually measure the rate of blood flow in the brain. And the inventor of that method, Walter Robrist, just moved to Penn when I was settling down and starting to do my research. So I went to him and I said, can I use your machine? He said, what for? And I said, I want to see what happens in the brain when people think. And he said, well, sit down and I'll talk to you for 15 minutes and that's probably going to be our last meeting. And then he went on to explain to me why there is no reason that there will be any changes in blood flow in the brain when people engage in cognitive activity. There is ample oxygen in the blood. There is no reservoirs, and the blood gets the first pick. I mean, the brain gets the first pick of blood coming straight from the lungs, so there is enough oxygen there. He says, I'm studying people in coma, and I hope my method will let me see which people will come out of the coma and which will not. That will be the contribution of this method, but don't even think in the direction of looking at anything psychological there. I said, well, okay, what if I still want to do it? I'm really interested. He said, well, I'm not going to waste any time on my machine, but I'm building exactly the same machine for Professor Rajvic across the hall, who was the head of the stroke center. If he lets you do it, you know, that's fine with me. So I went across the hall and told Rajvic, and Rajvic said, why don't you send me a memo describing what you want to do? So that came back to my office over in psychology. I wrote a brief description of an experiment I'd like to do, dropped it by his office on the way home, and didn't hear from him for 3 months. Then I get a call from his secretary asking, when am I available for a site visit? He said, what site visit? She says, for the stroke center. Well, okay, I can come, but why? He says, well, you have a project in our renewal application. A project? So, long story short, Rajvic turned my memo into a project, and it was one of the projects, and one of the site visitors was, I saw on the list, Arthur Benton, who is someone I had tremendous respect. He's one of those who really created the original neuropsychological batteries. So that put the fear of God in my heart, and I was really worried. But it turned out after that site visit that the whole stroke center was disapproved, but there was one project that was rated as outstanding, and that there even was some discussion as to whether it's worth keeping the whole stroke center so that project can take place. And what happened really was that I was trained in psychology, and it didn't occur to me to write a proposal for a study without stipulating my hypotheses and explaining how I'm going to analyze the data in order to test them, and that was the only project that did that. This was a time when if you're a famous investigator, an MD, and you apply for a grant, you get it. You don't look for hypotheses and stuff like that. So basically, I became the statistician for the stroke center. We rewrote the whole stroke center application, put hypotheses in all the different projects, and got the center going, and that's how I got started in this research. So that's the historical note. Now, the other thing we realized right away is that we can't just give neuropsychological tests inside the scanner. These are highly interactive tests. You have to give stimuli, you have to write down the response, you later have to score it. And with the xenon inhalation procedure, you were lying and you had this face mask through which you would inhale the xenon, and you had a hockey helmet that we jerry-rigged to put the detectors on it, and you couldn't interact with the subject. So we realized very quickly that we have to come up with tasks that require minimal interaction and that will really measure a very narrow dimension, because we're also interested in activating a specific brain system. And, you know, a series of studies came out, and we showed indeed that blood flow does go up by 15% to 20% when people think compared to when they're just resting, and then it goes up more in the left hemisphere for verbal tasks, more in the right hemisphere for spatial tasks. And after every experiment, every study, I would take the raw data, bring them to Walter Robrist, and ask him to go over it to see if there is any artifact. And he took that very seriously. And by the time the first experiment was over, he was converted, and he made some outrageous statements in the next site visit we had. He said, I can look at those numbers and know what the person was thinking. And only Walter Robrist can say that and make site visitors believe him. But anyway, That's how we got started, and we ended up with a bunch of very fast, easy to administer tasks. And then we said, gee, maybe they can become the neuropsychological battery of the future. They're much easier, they're faster, and it turns out that you string them together, you pretty much cover most of the brain systems that we care about. And the whole thing will take maybe an hour and 15 minutes instead of a whole day. So we sort of created this computerized battery. I'll give you quickly some examples of, like, attention, our attention task, that's called the PEN-CPT. You see seven segments displays flashing at you 1 second, and you have to push a button every time you see a digit in the display. This is abstraction and mental flexibility. Matt Kurtz was a postdoc, created that. Click on the object that doesn't belong. Which object doesn't belong? It's obvious, right?
The square or the star.
You're thinking too hard. The square is obviously doesn't belong because it's the only square yet there, right? But you can argue that this star with the thick lines doesn't belong because everything else is with thin lines, or you can argue that the small star doesn't belong because all the other shapes are large. The computer knows whether it is thinking shape, thinking line thickness, or thinking size. And if you guess right, you will get a nice correct, and a new stimulus will appear. If you guess wrong, you get one of those nasty buzzes the computers can generate, and you get a new item. And once you discover the principle, the computer lets you rest on your glory for 10 trials, and then it switches on you. And then we find out what happens when you always come to one room for a lecture and it turns out there is construction. What do you do? That's the abstraction flexibility. Very similar, same principles as the Wisconsin card sorting test. Spatial memory, you see a bunch of those 3D shapes. David Glahn developed that. Then they're mixed in with other shapes and you have to say which shape you have seen before. Most people come out of it saying, this is stupid, I just totally guessed. How could I possibly do it? But actually the average percent correct is around 80. And that's because it's your right hemisphere that does it. The left hemisphere thinks it's silly, but the right hemisphere somehow picks up the correct answers. And then face memory, went to a mall on a weekend, that's where America is, and we offered $5 to anybody who would let us take his picture like this, so we created a big data set of faces. And face memory, you would see 20 of those, and then they'll be mixed in with others, and you'd tell me which one you've seen. So far, I'm talking about behavior. This is one that gave more another sex difference that also feels biological. This is a truck. It's uphill. It's half filled with water. Which of these lines describes the water level, how the water level will look? And as you know, the water level will always be parallel to the ground, and that, so O is the correct answer. It was picked up by nearly half the males, but only 16% of the females gave a correct answer. This is a related problem. There is a rope hanging from the X, and that's what is the orientation of the rope. Again, the answer is O. The rope is always perpendicular to the ground, and that's almost 60% of the females, of the males, but only 30% of the females picked up. And these are all college students. Now, those of you, I won't tell you which college. Those of you who are developmentalists and know that according to Piaget, we should all know this thing by age 13, but apparently the sex difference is very clear. One time I gave a seminar in biology, and there were 30 students, and I had 3 hours, so I thought I'll do an experiment and put this task and gave it to the person to my left and told them to finish it, do it while I'm giving my first hour and a half. And during the break, we analyzed the data and showed them the sex difference. Well, when my first hour and a half was over, I wanted to get my laptop back. I turned to the right, it wasn't there. I kept going back. It turned out only 4 people managed to do it in this hour and a half. With my luck, the first 4 people were female. So I quickly got another 4 males to do it during the break, and I had my my demonstration. But you can see the sex, you can feel the sex. Even females who do perfectly on that, they consider it a task, a challenge, a question they have to think about each item. Whereas a lot of males, well, not all of them, I mean, whenever males get too smug, I point out that it's only about half of them, you know, who get it right, but they do it faster. So now, all this deals with cognition. So far, I haven't mentioned emotion, and I think you'll all agree that emotion has been the dark side of the moon for psychology for years. I think we have done a spectacular job with cognition, but pretty much neglected emotion until quite recently. And in emotion, the sex differences are written in big letters. You don't have to do any careful library or empirical research. You just open this morning's paper, and if you hear a story about a person attacking physically another person, and you bet that this is going to be a male, you'll be right something like 40,000 times, 40,000 to one. You cannot divide people into two groups. That will give you a bigger difference in any behavior than just dividing people into males and females and looking at the probability of engaging in physical aggression. So this summarized here, men fight, women talk things over. And in order to study emotion, we followed Charles Darwin's advice, and Charles Darwin said, if you want to study emotion, go for the face. And as you can see here, all those bodies look identical, but if you look at the face, you can pretty much tell where the body is lying in the path of the motorcycle, right? And Charles Darwin also pointed out that the expression of emotions are not unique for our species, and that an angry human and an angry dog will literally move exactly the same muscle. So if you see a dog like that and you're wandering through the forest, you'll know exactly what this dog is feeling and what to do about it. And similarly, if you have a dog and you try to growl at your dog, you'll see your nicest, calmest dog will freak out. I mean, they really respond to facial expressions. The problem is that we didn't have stimuli, so we needed to generate stimuli, and the only stimuli available were Ekman and Friesen, and they were all Caucasian, and they were old, and they were all posed. So they went through a lot of instruction on how to move each muscle, and so we wanted to get more natural stimuli. And just with luck, I went to a party and ran into this guy who introduces himself to me as Aaron Posner. And I said, thinking of something else to do, I said, well, you don't happen to be, I know one Posner, Mike Posner, is a very well-known cognitive psychologist. He was at Cornell, actually, in the medical school, right? And Aaron said, that's my dad. And it turns out that Aaron is a theater director and is really credited with starting a theater renaissance in Philadelphia by founding the Arden Theater. And he knew all the actors and actresses in Philadelphia, so I told him, hey, let's collaborate on that. And at that time, we had a grateful patient who gave a $100,000 donation, and we were off and running. And he brought in 150 actors and actresses, half male, half female, age range 12 to 91. And they really represented the ethnic diversity of Philadelphia. So now the problem is that the different methods of acting, you know, the Russian method and the English method. The English don't think that you have to feel an emotion in order to act. You're a paid professional, so go ahead, do it, and they teach them techniques. Whereas the Russians say that's all nice and good, but if you really want to act, you have to feel it. And so they go through a lot of exercises where they bring you in touch with your emotions and your memories. And so if I remind you of how you were punished for something your older brother or older sister did, and that's when the rage swells up, and now you're ready to go play King Lear. So that's very different. These were American actors. They were schooled in both methods, so we took pictures of both methods. And basically, we were asking them to display the main emotions. And the textbooks at the time said there are six universal emotions, and these were happy, sad, anger, fear, and disgust, and surprise. Aaron says, I could give you five of those. He says, why five? He says, because surprise is not an emotion. What do you mean surprises? I showed him the textbook. He says, well, I don't care what your textbook says. Surprise is not an emotion. I said, why? And he said, literally, he said, if you get an early break from work and you come home and you find that your significant other also had an early break so you can spend a pleasant afternoon together, it's a happy surprise. But if you find your significant other's having a good time with somebody else, that's an angry surprise. And so really, surprise is not an emotion. It can be happy or sad or angry or fearful depending on what surprises you. So I couldn't argue with him, and we don't have surprise, which caused us endless grief with reviewers. The problem with the Russian method is that the actors really get into it and they start screaming and yelling and so on. So we couldn't at the same time have them sit with their face straight so we can get a good shot. So I had to turn to my friends, the geeks over in the engineering school, and they set me up with this contraption that has six digital cameras in it, and each camera takes the face from a different angle. And then they use a program that was developed for NASA where you take satellite images from different angles and fuse them into three-dimensional displays. And that's basically the procedure we used. And here is an example. Can you see that really needs darker?
Second switch from this side.
Oh, now you see it. Oops, wait a second. So this is basically what comes out of this exercise, a three-dimensional. What is the expression? You said something else that I could do medium light?
Yeah, you see that box next to you? The beer box next to you. There.
Yeah. I see.
You push them, you get that.
Perfect. Thank you. That's perfect. So you saw it, right? What is the emotion? Fear, yeah, good. And what also you can do with those three-dimensional faces, you can change the angle, you can rotate them up, down, sideways, and so forth. And these are some examples of the expressions, happy, sad, anger, fear, and disgust. And then we started giving them to people, and it turns out that there are some people who can detect emotion and some people who can't detect very well. So we get variability in performance. This is in terms of the development. Here is a group of typically developing adolescents, and there's one group of 12 to 15-year-old, another group of 16 to 18-year-old, and they're all compared to the sample of adults. And one thing that stands out is that for attention, the younger adolescents still have a way to go to improve, but in other functions they are okay, except for emotion processing. They have a hard time telling their emotions. Now, if you go to a sample of vulnerable adolescents, and these are adolescents who have parents, one of the parents has schizophrenia, you can see that they actually have already deficits. And the clearer deficit, both for the younger and older adolescents, is in the memory functions, and in emotion. So emotion and memory sort of go together, and if you think of it, I mean, we'll get to the neural substrate in a moment. They share a lot of human substrate. Another reason we're interested in emotion is that flat affect is one of the major and most devastating symptoms of schizophrenia. When we started at the beginning, people were mostly impressed with the positive symptoms, the spectacular symptoms of hallucinations, delusions, bizarre behavior, and thought disorder. These stood out. But these actually respond well to medication, even first-generation antipsychotic. And what turns out to be a more devastating constellation of symptoms are the so-called negative symptoms, and chief among them is flat affect. these patients can do not express affect either in the face or in the voice. They're just flat. And when the patient has it, you know. And when they don't have it, you know. So it was, we had a prospective study to look at patients with flat affect and without flat affect. And note that among 63 patients with flat affect, 47 men, only 16 women. So men are more susceptible both to schizophrenia, but especially within schizophrenia, to having flat affect. And if you have flat affect, this is the premorbid course is worse. Your quality of life is substantially worse. And looking a year after at the outcome of treatment is also worse. So negative symptoms are a bad sign. But they're not dumber. The neurocognitive profile is exactly the same, no significant differences, except for verbal memory, where people with flat affect do more poorly, and the emotion tasks, emotion identification tasks, where they do more poorly. Now, one thing that came out, and I'm still on the realm of behavior, one thing that came out of computerizing those tests is all of a sudden we could do massive testing. We could put the tests on the web with Flash programming, and all of a sudden we could administer tests to a lot of people, and we set up a collaboration with, there are three different consortia, but together there are maybe 34 universities, the research centers that participate, and they can collect data using the computerized tests. So now we have samples. This is just Caucasians. 1,241 healthy subjects, 1,395 people with schizophrenia, almost 1,500 first-degree relatives of the patients, and 558 more distant relative of the patients. And now, the other nice thing about the computerized testing is that you can clearly separate accuracy from speed. As you know, speed and accuracy are the two bulls of the performance, the two horns of the performance bull. You can be perfectly accurate if you have all the time in the world, or you can be very fast if you don't worry about making mistakes. But life of performance is about striking a balance between the two. And so we can separate accuracy, speed, and then we also created a variable we call efficiency, which is accuracy divided by the log of response time, and that tells you how many correct items can you generate per unit time. But I mean, I won't go into the details of this, but one thing that struck us is that if you look at these are the patients, of course, they are very impaired, but the first degree relatives are almost there. They're almost as impaired as the patients. And that sort of caused us to rethink our ideas of genetics of schizophrenia. We used to think that we are going to find a gene or a set of genes that will distinguish schizophrenia from non-schizophrenia. And that was the model. It was a discrete disease model. You either had schizophrenia or you don't, and we'll compare your genes. And this approach has not yielded results. We still don't have good replicated findings after years and years of doing those kinds of studies. So maybe we need to rethink, and maybe schizophrenia is not necessarily defined by the clinical symptoms, but part of it is the cognitive deficits and the emotion processing deficits. And these are continuous variables that you can measure both in patients and in healthy people and in family members. And when some of them combine, then you get the diagnosis of schizophrenia. So it's a different way of doing the studies and analyzing them. Now, all this is good for measuring the perception of emotion, but after all, flat affect is decided by a clinician who talks with a patient for an hour and then says, or sometimes a lot less than that, and says that they have flat affect, and we're looking for ways of quantifying that. And again, our geeky friends from the image processing lab came up with a solution, and they use the same method as they use for computer fusing images, It's basically you take a neutral face, you take a happy face, and then you warp the happy face into the neutral face. But remember, for each pixel, how much you had to shrink or to expand in order to get there. So you get a vector map, and that can be color-coded, and you have a signature of a particular emotion. And now, if somebody tells you computers can't read emotions, you can tell them they didn't used to, but now they can. Every emotion is specific, and the computer is excellent at picking up the emotion on still faces. We then pushed it a bit further to see what will happen. And this shows an example of healthy controls in patients with schizophrenia. And you can see that the patients do express emotions, but it's different. Sometimes it's not quite what it should be. Sometimes it's exaggerated. How do you quantify those things? So we went forward and did videos and had the computer track the face and give us a decision of what the emotion is, a really second-by-second decision what the emotion is by comparing it to the template. And you can see the computer is doing pretty well in classifying the emotion on a video. And now you can ask, what happens if I give people, patients, a video? The upper row is example of the controls. The bottom is schizophrenia. So happy is green, sad is brown, anger is red, fear is yellow, and neutral is blue. And you can see for a healthy person, if we have them experience a happy experience, they're telling us a happy anecdote, the green becomes dominant very quickly. And for a sad, it's the brown, and for the anger is the red, and for the fear is the yellow. But if you look at patients, happy is okay, but once you get to those other emotions, you get a lot of mixture of emotion, and they spend actually a lot of time on other emotions and on neutral faces. And this summarizes overall, healthy control will spend most of the time either neutral or the target emotion, whereas patients will spend a lot of time neutral and then about the same amount of time on the target and other emotions. So now we have an objective way of quantifying flat affect. We can interview a patient and come up with a number that tells us how flat the affect is. So now we come to the anatomic substrate, and I don't need to explain to you about anatomy, but the main thing I want to point out is that when we look at the brain, the main two compartments of a nerve are the cell body and then the fiber, the axon. And those red notches that you see, the nodes, the myelin sheath, is in reality white rather than red, and that's what the brain does in order to insulate the signal that goes down. You know, the way it works is that you get the neurotransmitters are attach themselves to the dendrite and causes a change in the polarity, which produces a pulse that travels down the membrane and down the axon and shoots out of the axon terminal, which produces another, which releases more neurotransmitters, and if then there is another neuron, then it will propagate. If there is a muscle, the muscle will contract, and that's how the brain controls behavior, right? Now, the myelin really is made of fat, and the brain uses fat the same way the electrical company uses rubber to shield the electricity. And so if we can measure the amount of fat in the brain and the amount of proteins and the amount of fluid, we can begin to look at development. And this is really what the first work on brain development by the post-mortem method. Yakovlev and his colleagues at Harvard had a huge collection of post-mortem brain, a lot of premature fetuses, but also younger and very old people. They had very few people in between. But they had this stain that they put on the slices of the brain, and that stain attracts itself to fat and paints it black. So if you look at the 25 weeks of gestation brain, there is no black there. At full term, you can begin to see black in the stain. This is the corpus callosum. At term, very gray. 1 year old, it begins to darken. 28-year-old, pitch black. So They figured that by looking at how much black goes into the brain, they can figure out how fast each region of the brain myelinates. And on the basis of their data, they put together developmental trajectories, and that's where they had a startling finding that they really didn't expect, which is that different parts of the brain myelinate at a different rate. If you take a newborn infant, there's almost no white matter. There's no myelin, almost none in the whole brain. That's why when you tickle the right foot of a newborn, they'll move both arms. They can't really direct the activity to go where it's supposed to go. And the ability to control your movement comes hand in hand with the development of myelin, with the process of myelination. And that's the motor system is done by about the end of the first year of life. But look here, if you look at association cortex and especially frontal regions, according to Yakovlev's projection, they are not done until sometime in the middle of the third decade of life. So they take much longer to come on board. So now we didn't have to wait for the people to die to look at the brain. We could do MRI when they were still alive. And with MRI, we have the same problem of how to average different MRIs. And basically what we do is we line them up and make three-dimensional models, 3D MRIs. We throw away the skin, although those geeks didn't want to throw away anything, so they put the skin together and you get a picture of our chief of radiology on the upper left. But by using specific sequences, especially, you know how MR works, right? You put the head in a very strong magnetic field, many times the strength of the planets. And so the molecules in the brain align themselves with that force. And then you send a radio frequency pulse at an angle to that force. So the molecules try to align themselves with a new force, but that force is gone in 20 milliseconds. So they go back to the original force. And in the same way that if I took a pen and bent it and let it come back, it wouldn't just stand there, it will rattle. Those molecules also rattle when they get back to position, and that's the resonance that we can record using radio antennas the head is surrounded with. And of course there is a big principle in biology: small bodies move fast, big bodies move slowly. So the smallest and most abundant molecule in the brain is water. And so the water molecules rattle first, then come the proteins, and last come the big fat molecules. And so depending on when you listen, you get, if you listen very early, you get high intensity from the water signal, from the fluid. You listen later, you get better separation of gray matter and white matter, and these data will be fed into the computer. It used to be we would give it to the computer before we left work, and the next morning when we came back, the brain would be segmented into the three main compartments: gray matter, white matter, and fluid. As you know, the brain floats in fluid, which is good. Otherwise, you get head injury every time you sneeze. The back of your head is very nice and smooth, but the front has a lot of nasty bones that the brain is really sitting on top and can hit them. So the fluid serves to cushion. Since we know the dimension of each voxel in the MRI, we can calculate precisely the volume of each one of those compartments. Now, this is an old study of 10,000 autopsies where the Kaban and his colleagues took weighed the brain. They took out the brain and put it on a scale and measured how many kilos. And you can see that the brain weight climbs and continues to climb until early 20s. Then it stays about stable, and then at the 40s and later, things begin to go south again. But the reason the brain weight goes up is when you look at the MRI and segment into gray matter and white matter, it's white matter that increases in volume, gray matter actually goes down, and that was replicated in several studies. And again, this process, the apex of both processes. Now, why do we lose gray matter? The idea is that this is what Hattenlocher suggested. This was reflective of pruning, that brain regions that haven't been used, the brain figures you don't need them, and they basically shrivel off. We know that every time a neuron fires, it adds to its viability, and if it doesn't fire for a while, it will die. And so that's why if you didn't learn how to play the violin before you turned around 13, you will never be a concert violinist. That part of your brain will just die. And other phenomena like that. There are a lot of things that if you didn't learn before you were adolescent, you might as well forget it. And that's a fairly aggressive process of pruning. And here is a sample that we did in collaboration with a Japanese group, Matsuzawa Matsui and their colleagues in Toyama University. They scanned babies 1 month old, 3 months old, 4 months old. So they got MRIs of very tiny babies. And again, you see that gray matter goes down and white matter goes up as they develop. They then scan those babies 2 years later, and we can do a subtraction. Each baby's image was subtracted from the image of 2 years ago in the direction that yellow indicates myelination. And you can see that between age 0 and 2, mostly the cerebellum myelinates and some sensory area, but you don't even see the corpus callosum. The corpus callosum shows up between age 2 and 4. By age 14, the corpus callosum is very clear, and you can see the entire sensory motor cortex myelinated. The cerebellum is well myelinated, but the entire frontal lobe is still green and blue. Myelin doesn't reach there yet. I mean, and that I think relates to everybody's experience with adolescence, right? I mean, even our own. I mean, it's not that they are dumber. They can do math great. They can reason very well. But then they do some things that leave adults aghast. I mean, what were you thinking? And the answer usually is they can explain to you everything that was wrong in what they did, except it didn't occur to them at the moment. And that's the reason is that the highway between the brain and the executive part in the frontal lobe is still under construction. It just doesn't work as smoothly. Now, if you take adults, we find another sex difference. And this is cranial volume. You know that men have bigger heads proportionate to the bigger size of the body. So, and the question is, how come? Well, as an undergraduate, I was given an example of a study that showed the correlation between head size and IQ as an example of how you can go silly with correlations and stuff. Now, many years later, we can measure cranial volume, and we can measure brain volume, and the correlation between brain volume and IQ is exactly the same as the correlation between head size and IQ. It's 0.4. So it's not huge, but it's there. And yet, males and females get the same IQ. How can that be? Well, here is the answer. In males, for every unit increase in cranial volume, you get these two lines are parallel. You get equal increase in gray matter and in white matter. In female, there is a disproportionate increase in gray matter relative to white matter. So at the end of the day, the volume of gray matter is identical in males and females. And that's what correlates with the IQ measures. So if you ask what do men pack into their bigger crania, I guess the answer is fat and fluid. But of course, fat is an important ingredient in the brain, as is fluid. And men need more fluid because they're more likely to get into fist fights and get blown on the head. So now we come to physiology. And the first method we used was PET, positron emission tomography, and that measured rate of glucose metabolism. Now, you have to remember that the images you get from PET are not anatomic, even though they look anatomic, so you have to really fuse them with anatomic image to know where you are. But once you are done, you can look at a set of regions of interest, and that's where another big sex difference came, revealed itself. These are the brain regions arranged from frontal, parietal, occipital, temporal, limbic, corpus callosum. I didn't know where to stick it, so it's here. Then basal ganglia, diencephalon, brainstem, cerebellum. And if you look at the region to whole brain ratio of metabolism, you see that males and females have identical metabolism. By the way, in terms of quantitation, males and females have the same rate of metabolic activity in the brain, 4.52 milliliters per 100 gram of tissue per minute, exactly the same. But if you look regionally, as soon as you get to the temporal limbic system, you see that in all limbic regions that are below the corpus callosum, men have higher metabolism than women. But in the cingulate gyrus, which is only 2 points here, but it's a big piece of real estate, women have higher metabolism. And the effect is illustrated here in this cartoon, this average image. Women have higher metabolism through the entire cingulate gyrus, whereas men have higher metabolism in the lower limbic system. As you know, the lower limbic system is more primitive, is a system that we share with crocodiles, have it really fully developed, whereas the cingulate gyrus is more refined cortex. It's part of the limbic system, but it's adjacent to speech areas. So perhaps this is part of why women have an easier time talking about their feelings. And the effect size is about the same as the sex difference in height and weight. You do have some females who show a male typical metabolic pattern, very few. A lot more males who show the female typical, but by and large, it's about the same difference as you see in height and weight. And it's important to remember, of course, that we are talking about averages, and also in height and weight, although men are taller and weigh more, actually the highest weight was recorded by one of our female participants. So what is true of the average is not necessarily true of every individual in the group. Now along came fMRI, and the way fMRI works, if you remember the big magnet and the radio frequency pulse that you send, what we say is, let's, instead of getting a good solid image of the anatomy, let's get a quick snapshot picture. Now this shows how we had to adjust the activation, it's a cartoon, to be able to respond from inside the magnet, so we need fiber optic response device, it's called the FORP, and we need to project the stimuli. It's quite complicated because the MRI is in a big tunnel, and it's just a technical thing to overcome. But the principle of fMRI is you get a lot of those crappy images, here in this study, we ask the subject to move their fingers like that for 20 seconds. We get the whole brain image in 2 seconds. It's about 100 millisecond a slice. And then for 20 seconds, we take image after image when they were going like this, and then 20 seconds where they were not doing anything, another 20 when they were moving their finger, another 20 when they were doing nothing. And then when you subtract all the images when they were doing something minus all the images when they were not doing anything, you get an area of increased activity here. And the reason is that when a brain region becomes active, there is a fresh gush of blood, and that blood has oxygen, and oxygen gives off a better signal for the MR. So it's basically a susceptibility artifact that we're capitalizing on. Then you do statistical procedures to eliminate false activations, and you end up with this nice color that you can then put on a structural image, and this is what we end up publishing. But this region is exactly the region in the left hemisphere that controls the movement of the right hand. It's on the right because radiologists like to look at the body from the bottom up. So if you see an MR by a radiologist, the left will be on the right and the right will be on the left, and neurologists will do it the opposite way. And you can use fMRI also in the block. You can use it in the block design, where there's one condition when they do one thing and another when they do something else, or you can do use it in an event-related design, where you give one stimulus at a time. It turns out that the hemodynamic response, the increase in blood flow to a particular area that gets activated, takes about 8 seconds, 6 to 8 seconds to reach its peak, and then it goes back to normal, and sometimes there is a dip below normal. You can, if you do the experiment right, for example, if you space the stimuli by 16 seconds, or if you can do jittering because you really want to sample a lot from the first 6 to 8 seconds and you don't need to sample as much later on, you can analyze your data in an event-related fashion. Take the average hemodynamic response to a particular class. This is a simple study using P300 paradigm. It simulates attention. You have a target. Suppose you're supposed to read a book. And so they're supposed to push a button every time the target appears. But most of what they see is the standard, which is a red circle. So they see a red circle. They're not supposed to do anything. They'll see mostly red circle. Every once in a while, they'll see a green circle. Then they're supposed to push a target. And without forewarning, every once in a while, they'll get a novel stimuli. We used fractal images. And you can clearly see a difference between patients and controls. Controls activate in red, patients in green, and the overlap is yellow. And by and large, you can see that controls activate more than patients for the target. But the opposite happens for novel. Patients have big regions that activate. They activate that controls don't activate. And that relates to patients devoting less. This is the subtraction image. And you can see that if you look at target, in most regions, controls activate more than patients. So in STG, in putamen, insula, thalamus. But for novel, in most cases, patients activate more than controls. So they have less resources to devote to the target, and they are more easily distracted. Then we use this fMRI. We can use also to look at emotion processing. And the first study we did was with the block design. We showed those pictures that I just showed you how we created. And one block, the subject was supposed to say if the emotion is positive or negative. Next block, the same emotional pictures, but the subject was asked whether the person was younger or older than 30. So emotion was not relevant. So at the end, when you subtract emotion minus age, takes out all the face processing and that sort of stuff, you clearly see activation in limbic system, amygdala, and some hippocampal activation. Now, here is another sex difference. As you know, I didn't show the slide, but females are much faster and more accurate in emotion discrimination. We just recently had the opportunity to test the viewers of the Today Show, NBC Today Show, had a show on sex differences. They asked us, can we put a test on the web that we can illustrate some of it? So we gave them an emotion discrimination task and a line orientation task, where you had to move one line until it had the same angle as another line. And 5 minutes after the show, our servers crashed, but because of the flood of tests. But we still managed to rescue about 10,000 subjects from it. And it's very clear the females are faster and more accurate in emotion discrimination. Males are faster and more accurate in line orientation. And you can see with the fMRI that for men, the task of judging emotion creates a virtual limbic storm. Whereas in women, there's a punctual activation of the amygdala, clearly here, and some visual cortex, but that's basically it. So they are more efficient with that. When you look at schizophrenia, schizophrenia shows a limbic desert. There's almost no limbic activation. I'm almost there. Another minute. So we wanted to see what causes this abnormal activation, whether we can separate the top-down task of your task is to discriminate emotion, the activation associated with that, and separate from that what happens when a specific emotion appears. So in this study, we used a hybrid design, which is both block and event-related. So in each block, the task was to identify different emotions. So they will see all the time faces with different emotions. One block there to say, push a button every time it's happy. Next block, every time it's sad. Next block, every time it's angry. Next block, every time it's fearful. And here are the controls. If you look at the blocked analysis, here are the controls and the patients, and this is the difference. And you can see that patients, that controls activate the amygdala, inferior frontal, hippocampus, and thalamus significantly more than patients. But now when we ask the event-related question, what happens when a particular face appear, and we could also separate them into when the response was correct versus incorrect, we got that in controls, when the amygdala activated for happy faces, actually they are more likely to say not happy. No difference for sad, but both anger and fear, greater amygdala activation was associated with greater, with correct responding relative to incorrect responding. If you look at the patients, we saw the opposite, that actual greater amygdala activation, and that's illustrated here with blue, the incorrect responses in patients were associated with greater amygdala activation. In other words, when they see a fearful face and the amygdala activates, patients are likely to say, this is not fear. This is something else. This summarizes the effect. So we asked, well, how does that correlate with flat affect? And it turns out that, indeed, specifically for fear, there is a huge correlation with greater amygdala activation to fear associated with flat affect. And this is the scatter plot. The flat affect ratings were done by clinicians during their regular research evaluations. You may be used to those kinds of correlations, but in my many years, when I see a correlation like that, it means that I correlated two variables that are the same, pretty much. But this one variable comes from the imaging, the other comes from clinician ratings. So the greater, paradoxically, the more the amygdala activates for fearful faces in the patient, the more likely they are to have flat affect. And I think I'm done. I just can't end without generating some Tesla envy. We just got our new 7 Tesla scanner, and we are very pleased with the images coming out of it, so I thought I'll share them with you. This is literally from day before yesterday. Where you can see the difference with 7 Tesla. The SNR is spectacular, 65 compared to 26 with the 3 Tesla, and you can clearly see that this image is much much better and less grainy than the 3 Tesla. So we hope with the 7 Tesla to be able to really study the amygdala, hippocampus, and this whole region, because unfortunately these are regions that are right next to air passages, and that produces susceptibility artifacts that are very difficult to overcome, and you want to make very small voxels to make sure that you are in tissue and not in area that borders with air. Now, with high Tesla, you also get higher susceptibility artifacts, but you get a lot more signal in a very short time, so we can make tiny tiny voxels that we can cover very fast. Yeah, I won't tell you about the deception work. I think unless you want me to. Okay. Well, just quickly, I mean, because it's the legal implications, I think, are really quite pronounced. I mean, we have a long tradition of trying to detect deception, and we try to detect it based on behavior. And yesterday, I met someone who is doing spectacular work here on just using speech samples in order to try to detect if somebody's lying or not. I mean, the Inquisition had its own method, you know, the dry bread method, to know if you're lying when you say you're not a witch. We'll put dry bread in your mouth and ask you a bunch of questions and then take it out. If the bread is still dry, it means you're lying, because anxiety produces a dry mouth. So, I mean, some of the modern methods are not much better, but... the main point is that the main method being used now, the polygraph, really looks at the peripheral nervous system response. So unless you get anxious or nervous about lying, then it won't detect it. And so if you are used to lying, like if you are a politician, it won't work. CNS is really where the active act of lying, the central nervous system, is where it occurs. And there are different methods to probe that. This is our first foray into that with Daniel Langleben. And we used a guilty knowledge test, where basically it's a standard paradigm used in polygraphy. I'll ask you to select a card and then remember what the card is. And in fact, you get to keep the card, put it in an envelope with $20. And I tell you, if you manage to lie truthfully, you'll lie truthfully. If you manage to convince, we have a computer here, that a scanner that will try to see if you're lying. If you manage to lie, you can keep the $20. And for enhanced dramatics, we put it under the head inside the scanner. And then we show them cards and say, is this the card you have? Is this the card you have? Is this the card you have? And we know which card they have through the simple tricks that all the cards we offered were exactly the same. So, and when you look from, subtract lie from truth, what stood out was frontal activation, especially anterior cingulate and superior and inferior frontal regions. So we now decided to take the next step then, to look at what happens if we give you a choice, because in real life you do have a choice. So we had them take two cards and they chose which one to lie about and which one not to lie about. You have this card. This is basically the study. And to illustrate the effect, I'll do what physicists call the blink comparator. This is the lie minus truth. These are the voxels where lie activated more than truth. And this is where truth activated more than lie. And I'll move back and forth, and you can see. Right? So this is really, I mean, the lying activates more frontal, and telling the truth more posterior. That's as simple as that. And actually, when we just took one by one, subject by subject, trial by trial, we got a pretty decent separation between lies and truth by using this blink comparator. I would look at an image, and we do it blindly, four different raters. We look at image, and we choose which one is the lie, and then we look at how well we did. And we're doing pretty good. Then we took it a step further. I enlisted the help of my son, who I asked to bring all his friends from kindergarten. So we brought a big group of people who were all friends, knew each other, and we divided them into triads, and each triad planned something nasty, and then we simulated that we caught them, and we now bring them one by one, and we tell them, we know that one of those two others was part of this. You can choose which one of your friends you are ready to betray and which one you are going to defend, but we know that it's at least one of your friends, we just don't know which, participated. So again, do you know this person? And this was a block design, an event-related study. These are the people who participated. And again, we find we can do a one-by-one determination of what trials were lie and which trials were not. And now we are just completed a study that we collaborated with a former FBI chief polygrapher and had a head-to-head comparison of a polygraph to fMRI. And, I mean, I don't know how to break the news to him, but it's no contest. It's just simply no contest. You can think what you want about fMRI as a lie detector, but the main problem with it is that it works. Yeah, I mean, thank you very much for your attention.
This has been a presentation by Human Development Outreach and Extension at Cornell University.